for the last talk. Well, Hugh Price gave me the perfect opening for my talk yesterday. I don't know if he intended to do so or not.
But I don't know how many of you noticed, but if you looked at his shirt, it was exactly the same color as the background or the borders in his transparencies. So when I woke up this morning, I thought, which shirt should I wear? And I ended up with this one. Well, this talk is going to be effectively nothing but quotes. It'll be quotes from Everettians and quotes from counter-Everettians, though they didn't know that they were counter-Everettians, most of them, because they lived 100 years ago. So let me start off with a quote, just so that you already catch the theme, and I'll read it to you. This is from the opening of William James's book, Pragmatism. This is why I guess you've mentioned it. The history of philosophy is to a great extent that of a certain clash of human temperament. Undignified as such a treatment may seem to some of my colleagues, I shall have to take account of this clash and explain a good many of the divergencies of philosophies by it. Of whatever temperament a professional philosopher is, he tries, when philosophizing, to sink the fact of his temperament. Temperament is no conventionally recognized reason, so he urges impersonal reasons only for his conclusions. Yet his temperament really gives him a stronger bias than any of his more strictly objective premises. It loads the evidence for him one way or the other, making a more sentimental or a more hard-hearted view of the universe, just as this fact or that principle would. He trusts his temperament. Wanting a universe that suits it, he believes in any representation of the universe that does suit it. He feels men of opposite temper to be out of key with the world's character, and most of you, I suspect, by the end of this talk, will feel that of me. He feels men of opposite temper to be out of key with the world's character, and in his heart considers them incompetent and not in it, in the philosophic business, even though they may far excel him in dialectical ability. Yet in the forum, he can make no claim on the bare ground of his temperament to superior discernment or authority. There arises thus a certain insincerity in our philosophic discussions. The potentest of all our premises is never mentioned. I am sure it would contribute to clearness if in these lectures we should break this rule and mention it, and I accordingly feel free to do so. Strikes me as the perfect introduction for everything that I'm about to say. I want to offer to you, the audience, myself, as a psychological study. And so the talk is of Everettian quotes and why they unsettle me. I'm going to do this in good faith. I know that I'm putting myself in front of a chalkboard and there are a lot of tomatoes out there. And I had feared that the strongest tomato thrower would be here this morning. He's not, apparently. But nevertheless, I put myself out in good faith. And what's that? And I just ask that if it unsettles you that I'm unsettled with certain things, please just be a little civilized in letting me know that. So James says that we should start off, or he says that he feels free to, it would contribute to the clearness of these lectures if he would say the potentest of all his premises. I'll reveal to you two of the most three potent premises in my life. Here's one. The hypothesis, this is from Martin Gardner. Quote number two, you can start counting. The hypothesis that there is an external world not dependent on human minds, made of something, is so obviously useful and so strongly confirmed by experience down through the ages that we can say without exaggerating that it is better confirmed than any other empirical hypothesis. I have no problem with that. I'm happy with the idea that there's a world out there that's independent of my mind. And I would say that indeed that is one of the potentest of my premises when I decided to become a scientist. make note of that. The other one comes from William James again, from an essay of his titled The Dilemma of Determinism. It's in the collection of essays called The Will to Believe. What does determinism profess? It professes that those parts of the universe already laid down absolutely appoint and decree what the other parts shall be. The future has no ambiguous possibilities bidden in its womb. The part we call the present is compatible with only one totality. Any other future complement than the one fixed from eternity is impossible. The whole is in each and every part and welds it with the rest into an absolute unity, an iron block, a block universe. He doesn't say block universe. In which there can be no equivocation or shadow of turning. He contrasts that with his idea of indeterminism. Indeterminism, on the contrary, says that the parts have a certain amount of loose play on one another, so that the laying down of one of them does not necessarily determine what the others shall be. It admits that possibilities may be in excess of actualities, and that things not yet revealed to our knowledge may really, in themselves, be ambiguous. Of two alternative futures which we conceive, both may now be really possible, and the one become impossible only at the very moment when the other excludes it by becoming real itself. Indeterminism thus denies the world to be one unbending unit of fact. It says there is a certain ultimate pluralism in it, and so saying, it corroborates our ordinary unsophisticated view of things. To that view, actualities seem to float in a wider sea of possibilities from out of which they are chosen. And somewhere, indeterminism says, such possibilities exist and form a part of the truth. I first came across that, a little piece of that quote, when I was looking at the Graham and DeWitt book on many universes, on many worlds theory, and I liked it. I liked it so much that ultimately I looked up this paper and read it. I would call this the second potentist of all my premises. I like it. I like the sound, that definition of determinism, and I think that I subscribe to it. Indeterminism. Did I say determinism? That was a horrible faux pas. Indeterminism, the part. Actualities seem to float on a wider sea of possibilities from out of which they are chosen. And somewhere, indeterminism says, such possibilities exist and form a part of the truth. I have no problem with that. But I'm here because I should be talking about the Everettian picture of the world and saying what I don't quite feel comfortable with about it. And this transparency is an attempt to capture exactly what I don't feel comfortable about. There's a fear in me, and has been in me for a long time, that the content of the Everettian worldview is what you see on the transparency. That it's empty. So, is it that it's too weird of a worldview that bothers me? Is it something that's so unacceptable to my classical intuition that I think it's so strange it must be rejected? No, it's not that. Instead, I think that it has a danger of not actually saying anything. And you know, when I wiped off the board, I wiped off that one and that one, but I left this one. And I think essentially the issue is right here with what Hugh Price expressed earlier. I'm not exactly made to feel better by reading the technical accounts of why we're motivated to it, nor the popular accounts. I think this one's worth seeing. This one's from David Deutsch in his book, The Fabric of Reality, him explaining why we're forced to an Everettian picture of the world. And just, again, this is a study in psychology, so let's focus on how it's explained. So he's talking about explaining one particle at a time interference. He has an interferometer. He has a detector. The particles are going through at such a low rate that ultimately we get about one click per some unit of time, and an interference pattern appears. Deutsch says, so if the photons do not split into fragments, he had argued for that earlier in the book, and are not being deflected by other photons, what does deflect them? When a single photon at a time is passing through the apparatus, what can be coming through the other slits to interfere with it? I shall now start calling the interfering entities photons. That is what they are. Though for the moment, it does appear that photons come in two sorts, which I shall temporarily call tangible photons and shadow photons. Tangible photons are the ones we can see or detect with instruments, whereas shadow photons are intangible, invisible, detectable only indirectly through their interference effects on tangible photons. He goes further down the line. He starts talking about shadow barriers as well, and so forth. And finally, he comes out with saying, thus we have inferred the existence of a seething, prodigiously complicated world of shadow photons. They travel at the speed of light, bounce off mirrors. Oh, I apologize. This does come almost immediately afterward. It's a little bit later that he talks about the shadow barriers. Thus, we've inferred the existence of a seething, prodigiously complicated, hidden world of shadow photons. They travel at the speed of light, bounce off mirrors, and are refracted by lenses, and are stopped by opaque barriers or filters of the wrong color. Yet they do not trigger even the most sensitive detectors. The only thing in the universe that a shadow photon can be observed to affect is the tangible photon it accompanies. That is the phenomenon of interference. Then he goes further with the argument and finally says, thus we have reached the conclusion of the chain of reasoning that begins with strangely shaped shadows and ends with parallel universes. Each step takes the form of noting that the behavior of objects that we observe can be explained only if there are unobserved objects present and if those unobserved objects have certain properties. Well, I didn't find that very satisfying, and I'm not sure it's because of my professional training as a physicist, assuming I have been trained as a physicist. Here's a little commentary from David Merman that I have liked from one of his papers, Teaching Computer Scientists Quantum Mechanics, from C-bits to Q-bits. There are nevertheless some who believe that all the amplitudes, he's talking about quantum computation now, there are some who believe that all the amplitudes, alpha sub x, have acquired the status of objective physical quantities, inaccessible though these quantities may be. Such people then wonder how that vast number of high precision calculations, 10 to the 30 different amplitudes if you have 100 qubits, could all have been physically implemented. Those who ask such questions like to provide sensational but fundamentally silly. Now, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say fundamentally silly, not in front of this audience. But this is what Merman said. Those who ask such questions like to provide sensational but fundamentally silly answers involving vast numbers of parallel universes, invoking a point of view known as the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. My own opinion is that, imaginative as this vision may appear, and people sometimes say that out of niceness, it is symptomatic of a lack of a much more subtle kind of imagination, which can grasp the exquisite distinction between quantum states and objective physical properties that quantum physics has forced upon us. So David's comment here, and it would be effectively my comment to the previous Deutsch explanation of interference, is that the argument runs, it takes as its starting point a very classical image of the world, and then says, let us make good sense of this classical image of the world as best we can, and we are seemingly carried away by the many worlds idea. But its starting point is a classical image of the world. It's not such a weird image of the world after all, I think. But coming back to this issue so here's the point, that didn't work for me. let us maybe go along the lines of this earlier remark that I fear that there's a kind of contentlessness to this theory, and I think it's a little bit captured by Hugh's point here. The most extreme example that one can find in the literature, and probably at this conference, was Max Tegmark. So let's look at Max. So Max has a deep concern with parallel universes, not only for Everettian quantum mechanics, but at all different sorts of levels of existence. And here's a compilation of quotes from two papers, one called Parallel Universes, the other one called The Mathematical Universe. So this first part is taken from the abstract. I survey physics theories involving parallel universes, which form a natural four-level hierarchy of multiverses, allowing progressively greater diversity. Level one, a generic prediction of inflation is da-da-da-da, he goes on. Level two, he goes on. Finally, at level three, he says, in unitary quantum mechanics, other branches of the wave function add nothing qualitatively new, he means, to the previous two levels, which is ironic given that this level has historically been the most controversial. Level four, other mathematical structures give different fundamental equations of physics. The key question is not whether parallel universes exist, but how many levels there are. So just think about the structure of this. He gives level one of parallel universes, level two of parallel universes, neither one of which took into account the particular structure of quantum mechanics, seemingly. He finally arrives at level three and says, here we have parallel universes again, but not much new has sprung up that didn't already in the previous levels. And now I'm going to move on to level four. Here's level four. If the theory of everything, he had TOE, at the top of figure one exists and is one day discovered, then an embarrassing question remains. Why these particular equations, not others? Why these particular equations, not others? Could there really be a fundamental unexplained ontological asymmetry built into the very heart of reality? Splitting mathematical structures into two classes, those with and without physical existence. After all, a mathematical structure is not created and doesn't exist somewhere, it just exists. As a way out of this philosophical conundrum, I have suggested that complete mathematical democracy holds that mathematical existence and physical existence are equivalent, so that all mathematical structures have the same ontological status. In the context of the mathematical universe hypothesis, which he explained in his talk, the existence of level four multiverse is not optional, which led Max to ultimately ask, does the universe in fact contain almost no information? I think maybe he touched on that in this talk, though not as much as he had in some previous talks here. What I have fun with doing is comparing Max, as I see him here, with another 101-year-old quote, again William James. I quote James a lot in this talk. He seemed to bring it out of me. He's talking about Hegelians and his sort of disgust with Hegelians and absolutistic philosophers, as he calls them. If you are the lover of facts I have supposed you to be, if you're empiricist, as I supposed you to be, you find the trail of the serpent of rationalism, of intellectualism, over everything that lies on that side of the line. You escape indeed the materialism that goes with the reigning empiricism, but you pay for your escape by losing contact with the concrete parts of life. The more absolutistic philosophers dwell on so high a level of abstraction that they never even try to come down. The absolute mind which they offer us, the mind that makes our universe by thinking it, might, for aught they show us to the contrary, have made any one of a million other universes just as well as this. You can deduce no single actual particular from the notion of it. It is compatible with any state of things, whatever being true here below. And the theistic God is almost as sterile a principle. You have to go to the world which he has created to get any inkling of his actual character. He is the kind of God that has once for all made that kind of world. The God of the theistic writers lives on as purely abstract heights as does the absolute. Absolutism has a certain sweep and dash about it, the way only William James could talk. While the usual theism is more insipid, but both are equally remote and vacuous. The mathematical structure which they offer us, the structure that makes our universe by thinking it, might, for aught they show us to the contrary, have made any one of a million other universes a check and a check. You can deduce no single actual particular from the notion of it. It's compatible with any state of things, whatever being true here below. And so I wonder about Everettism. Now, one can, I think, fruitfully explore these questions, not in such a philosophical way, but I think there's now a hope of maybe tackling this very issue in a mathematical way, leaning on some recent work by Howard Barnum, Jonathan Barrett, wherever John is, and Matt Leifer, I think he's somewhere in the audience. And I think this is good stuff to make note of, to pay attention to. So they start exploring what they call generic probabilistic models. These are not, this is not quantum mechanics, but a generalization of quantum mechanics. And they have spent some time exploring the kinds of quantum information protocols and quantum information theoretic restrictions that one can find in such structures. The setting for those theories, here's just one page out of one of their papers. Our approach to general probability theory begins with an abstract convex set of states. So instead of having density operators on a Hilbert space and thinking of that as a convex set, they start with abstract convex sets. Then they model the notion of an observable, I think somewhere down here in the second paragraph. Observables can now be defined in terms of affine functionals from this space of states onto the real unit interval. So by this, they mean probability assignments and so forth. They develop a structure that has some features in common with quantum mechanics, but it's much, much more general. It includes classical physics in some sense and includes quantum mechanics at another end. And then it includes lots of other things that are strange too. Now here's a nice quote. This whole talk is quotes. I wonder why I did that. From Alex Wills in his paper, Formalism and Interpretation in Quantum Theory. I don't think it's posted on the web yet, but he's talking about these generalized probabilistic theories. It has become increasingly clear in recent years that many of the most puzzling quantum phenomena, in particular phenomena associated with entanglement, and including, as I'll show, a version of the measurement problem, are in fact quite generic features of essentially all non-classical probabilistic theories, quantum or otherwise. There's a measurement problem duly stated in all of these theories, quantum and otherwise. This suggests that many of the interpretive ideas, now I added this, including many worlds interpretations, that have been advanced in connection with quantum mechanics can be carried over to a much more general setting. This exercise has something to offer to both foundational projects. He talked about two at the beginning. On the other hand, on the one hand, an interpretation of quantum mechanics that can't be made sense of absent certain special structural features of quantum mechanics is potentially a source of fruitful ideas with which to approach the problem of the formalism. On the other hand, if an interpretation can be kept aloft even in the thin atmosphere of a completely general non-classical probabilistic theory, if an interpretation can be kept aloft even in the thin atmosphere of a completely general non-classical probabilistic theory, then perhaps it has little to tell us about the physical content of quantum theory. To compress this idea into a slogan, a completely satisfactory interpretation of the physical theory should be capable of yielding or at least constraining its own formalism. So here would be a challenge I give to the Everettians. Go to these larger theories and see if what Alex is implying here, that one can make a mini worlds move in that larger framework. If you can, does that bother you? Or are you just caught up in the trail of the serpent of rationalism? Or if you can't, that's good to know. Let's pinpoint the features of quantum mechanics that actually compel a many worlds view. Try as I have to understand that one is compelled to a many worlds view, the usual statement is, because it's a linear theory, has left me cold. And I think one will find that much of that argument goes away in these. They're all linear theories. So let me not beat that dead horse. Next set of quotes. These are ones that get under my skin. The other ones didn't. These do.
I think one of them, because it was talking about meat. So here's Peter Byrne. I guess he's gone. I haven't seen him this morning. At the conference, I think he's talking about the Cambridge conference that you guys had. Was it Cambridge or Oxford? I apologize. At the conference, the strongest Everettian was physicist David Deutsch of the Center for Quantum Computation at the University of Oxford. Deutsch asserted that people have been wasting time for decades debating whether or not the Copenhagen interpretation is meaningful because, quote unquote, only Everett's theory consists of taking quantum mechanics seriously. If you take quantum mechanics seriously, you will be compelled to the Everettian approach. I think Simon said it very, very forcefully. So not only Deutsch, Simon, I've heard, and I guess many of you. Here's one from David Deutsch. It's sad enough when cranks churn out this tawdry old excuse for refusing to contemplate the implications of science. What he meant by that was the Everett interpretation. But when highly competent physicists, quantum physicists, dust it off and proudly repeat it, it's a crying shame. And finally, Wojciech Zurek at this conference saying, let the quantum be quantum. Only Everett's theory consists of taking quantum mechanics seriously. Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat. I'd love to know where that phrase came from. And I think there's more than one way to take quantum mechanics seriously. There is indeed the way that has been much discussed at this conference. I took this off of Simon's transparency. I didn't quite get the end of it, so I hope you'll fill that in. The theory is to apply universally, and I think what he meant by the theory is that there's a Hilbert space and there's unitary evolution of the vectors on the Hilbert space. That is the theory. Without any special mention of the observer or measurement, and without any special interpretive assumptions or additional postulates. The easiest thing I could have put in there. Well, that is indeed one way of taking quantum mechanics seriously. But not to break the chain of reading quotes, this one's from John Wheeler from his 1998 autobiography. Many students of chemistry and physics entering upon their study of quantum mechanics are told that quantum mechanics shows its essence in waves or clouds of probability. A system such as an atom is described by a wave function. This function satisfies the equation that Erwin Schrödinger published in 1926. The electron in this description is no longer a nugget of matter located at a point. It is pictured as a wave spread throughout the volume of the atom or other region of space. This picture is all right as far as it goes. Similarly here, I'll say the same thing. It properly emphasizes the central role of probability in quantum mechanics. The wave function tells where the electron might be, not where it is. But to my mind, the Schrödinger wave fails to capture the true essence of quantum mechanics. That essence, as the delayed choice experiment shows, is measurement. A suitable experiment can, in fact, locate an electron at a particular place within the atom. A different experiment can tell how fast the electron is moving. The wave function is not central to what we actually know about an electron or an atom. It only tells us the likelihood that a particular experiment will yield a particular result. It is the experiment that provides the actual information. Measurement, the act of turning potentiality into actuality, is an act of choice. Choice among possible outcomes. After the measurement, there are roads not taken. Before the measurement, all roads are possible, and one can even say that all roads are being taken at once. Again, a wink to Everettism. Fair enough. But to my mind, the Schrodinger wave fails to capture the true essence of quantum mechanics. So if I were mean-spirited, I would look to the Everettians in the audience and say, no, you're not taking quantum mechanics seriously. You're hung up with unitarity. Now, we've heard a lot about decision theory, and I think it's probably time to bring that up exactly in this context. The usual troubles with some kind of Copenhagen-like view or John Wheeler-like view is that one says, how can you hold the observer as a special system? How can you bring the observer outside of physics? Surely physics is one big story about the universe, and observers have no special role to play in the universe. That was one of the great lessons of Copernicus, and it has guided science since then. So I look at this book, Foundations of Statistics. It's a development of decision theory, and then from decision theory he gets the structure of probabilities. And I think to myself, this is a book on decision theory. Is he not taking decision theory seriously? He starts off with the gambling agent. That's the very starting point of the book. It's the subject matter of the book is the gambling agent. So I look to him and say, you're not taking decision theory seriously. You should give a derivation of where the agent comes from. You should give the exact conditions that delimit what an agent is and what an agent is not. So I go back into the book and I look at all of the postulates, all of the axioms of Savage, and I try to rearrange them and jiggle them until out of them crops up a pattern, like in some of David Wallace's papers, a pattern that I can call an agent. And I look in vain. I can look in there until I'm blue in the face, and I'll never find a way of deriving an agent from decision theory. The agent is the subject matter of decision theory. Now, what do I want to take for decision theory? Well, or at least take from it. I like this quote from Bernardo and Smith, their book Bayesian Theory, and I think it teaches us the right way to think about Bayesian statistics. There's been a lot of talk in this conference about rational agents, and none of us are rational, really. So how should we think of decision theory? What is the nature and scope of Bayesian statistics? Bayesian statistics offers a rationalist theory of personalistic beliefs in contexts of uncertainty, with the central aim of characterizing how an individual should act in order to avoid certain kinds of undesirable behavioral inconsistencies. The theory establishes that expected utility maximization provides the basis for rational decision making, and that Bayes' theorem provides the key to the ways in which beliefs should fit together in the light of changing evidence. The goal, in effect, is to establish rules and procedures for individuals concerned with disciplined uncertainty accounting. The theory is not descriptive in the sense of claiming to model actual behavior. Rather, it is prescriptive in the sense of saying, if you wish to avoid the possibility of these undesirable consequences, you must act in the following way. So decision theory is something that should be pragmatically viewed. It's something that we should strive to attain, and we'll never be able to do it perfectly. But if we would like to survive the longest in this world, it is to our best interest to try to be coherent, say, in the Diffinetti sense, in our probability assignments. Now, from this point of view, what is quantum mechanics about? Well, it's about an interaction between the subject matter of decision theory, which stylistically I've drawn as a person. I don't see why it couldn't be a Bayesian spam filter. It's whatever is the subject matter of decision theory, an interaction between that and some piece of the world that's external to him. I think the right way to think about quantum measurement is to think of the measurement actually as an action. When someone writes down a POVM, what they're writing down is a potential action that one can take upon a system. Taking the action upon the system ultimately leads to some consequence, just as in Savage's book, taking an act leads to a consequence. In this case, he goes, ouch. And a quantum state, well, what does that represent? Well, this is the perfect place where we have uncertainty. And what we've learned from Bayesian probability theory is that the central aim is to characterize how an individual should act in order to avoid certain kinds of undesirable behavioral inconsistencies in context of uncertainty. Here is a context of uncertainty. I make an act on a physical system like this cup. I can't predict the consequence. It is a context of uncertainty. I should use probability theory. So we have, again, these things, probabilities. Now, we've gotten hung up in thinking that probabilities must always be, or I should say we, a lot of us, and even us quantum Bayesians, Rudiger Schock and Carlton Caves and Marcus Appleby, and I dare put Matt Leifer in this group, but I will, have gotten hung up in thinking that whenever there's a probability, it must be uncertainty about some kind of state of a preexistent reality. I think the thing we've learned from quantum mechanics is that one can just as well talk about our degrees of belief about the consequences of our actions and leave it there. So this leads us, I think, to have this vision of the world. There it is. There's the world that's out there. And maybe more accurately, that's the world that was out there 2 billion years ago, before there was any sentient life. And through a great number of perhaps Darwinian accidents, there arose these little guys in the thick middle of it. And that phrase has to be taken seriously. They're in the thick middle of it. They're swimming around trying to survive. And they use decision theory to help their survival. Now, does this give the observer a preferred role in all of this? I'd say no, it doesn't. Because we can focus on this guy, and we can say he is the subject matter of decision theory. He's the agent in Savage's book. And with respect to him, all of this stuff out here is just physical junk that he could interact with. And with respect to him, this thing right here is also physical junk that he could interact with. And this thing over here is physical junk that he could interact with. There's nothing special about this. This might be an electron. It might be a very developed ape. Let's take this person's perspective. He is now the subject matter of decision theory. He's the agent in Savage's book. And with respect to him, all of this stuff is physical junk. And so is this. So is this little brown guy. And so is this little brown guy. And so forth. So here's the picture. What quantum mechanics is about is, first and foremost, underneath it all, some layer called decision theory or Bayesian probability. And by hook or crook, a little while after decision theory was discovered, we realized that we might as well take into account as much about the world as we can if we want to give ourselves the most survival value. And we noticed, ultimately, what's going to boil down to a statement, I believe the world independent of the agent, has some character, such and such character, has character X. Call it ontology, if you will. So among all of my beliefs about this or that, my belief about whether I'll die by the time I'm 73, there's also other beliefs. I believe that the world has a certain character about it, and that because it has that certain character, when I interact with pieces of the external world, I should take my degrees of belief and structure them in a certain way. So on top of this is another layer that says, has something to do with this. And this is quantum mechanics. And it sits on top of this. So we have a structure, the decision theory is the basic part, and then the next level up is to add some beliefs about the world, and that's what quantum mechanics is. So let me give you a sense of what one can mean by that, and then ultimately connect it back to issues of unsettlement with Everett. So what does it mean to say that I, the agent, who've already accepted decision theory, also accept quantum mechanics? I'd say, well, the most basic statement is that I think that I can represent my actions upon systems by orthogonal bases, and that the individual elements in the orthogonal bases represent the consequences of my actions. So if I have an orthogonal basis, it represents something I can do to a physical system. Let's say that one. If I have a different orthogonal basis, it represents something else I can do to that physical system. And with each of those actions will be consequences. To accept quantum mechanics as an addition to the decision theory, I'd say, can be taken along these lines, say, of Gleason's theorem. Here's what I'm accepting. If I consider this action, this particular orthonormal basis, and I ask myself, what are my degrees of belief about this outcome? Then in accepting quantum mechanics, I'm accepting that if I considered a different orthonormal basis, a different action that I could take, that's just gotten from the first one by a rotation around one of these, the way I'm doing with my finger, then I should assign the same degree of belief for this outcome as I had for that outcome. That's my identification between outcomes. Well, Gleason's theorem, this wonderful theorem, says that if you do that, if you start off with probabilistic coherence and then add a further kind of coherence about your degrees of belief, then you have to represent the probabilities in terms of density operators. So if you have a function that sums to 1 over all orthonormal bases, then there exists a density operator rho such that the function on the projector equals trace of rho pi. This is where quantum states come from this kind of point of view. Quantum states come from an extra statement of coherence that's on top of just raw decision theory. There's a physical system. Most of you have seen me use this transparency for 5 years. And there's a quantum state. And we're accustomed to thinking that the quantum state is something over and above a set of probability assignments. That's why we talk about quantum states. And that's why we have these interminable debates about the character of quantum states and how we can derive the Born rule. Because if the quantum states weren't something independent of the probabilities, would we really have a reason to derive the Born rule? Well, here's something that plays a large role in my thinking, and that is, you're right. This thing called the quantum state is nothing more than a middleman. We could do quantum mechanics without ever invoking the idea of a quantum state. It can be done away with. A simple way to do it is to introduce some particular measurement in the background or some particular basis for the space of density operators. The set of quantum states itself is a d squared dimensional vector space if the underlying Hilbert space is of dimension d. If we can find a measurement, if we can find a POVM, positive operator valued measurement, with the number of elements equal to the dimensionality of this space, such that all the elements are linearly independent, then what? Well, then you can look at the Born rule. It tells you that the probabilities of the outcomes are given by trace of rho on EH on these elements, where rho is the density operator. And that tells you Well, what is that? That trace of A times B, trace of one operator times another operator, is in fact, what are they called? Scalar product. It's a scalar product. So this represents, if you just notice that that's a scalar product, this represents the projection of this vector onto that vector. So if you have a set of operators that are linearly independent, they span the whole space, and the probabilities tell you nothing other than the projections of a vector onto these basis components. If you take a measurement that satisfies that property and fix it for all eternity, and call it a standard quantum measurement, and maybe you'd want to do that by taking it to the Bureau of Standards with the standard kilogram and the standard meter stick, then what you can do is get rid of this idea of a quantum state and substitute for it a probability distribution for all the outcomes that would arise if we were to take this system and perform that measurement on it. Just to make it concrete, let me give you a quick example. Suppose D squared projectors satisfy this simple relation that they're all symmetric with respect to each other. So if I take the inner product of any two of them, it's equal to a constant. Then one can prove that these are linearly independent. It follows from this statement. And one can also prove that if you rescale these guys, they sum up to the identity. So they do correspond to some physical measurement that can be performed. Therefore, they'd be good for this Bureau of Standards. And you can work out what the inversion formulas are. If you give me the probabilities, if I use this formula, I can calculate a density operator. If you give me a density operator, I can invert this and find the probabilities. So with that picture, there is no such thing as a quantum state anymore. It's just a probability assignment. It's that and nothing more. A quantum state is a probability assignment. No need to talk about anything else. What is the Born rule then, from this point of view? You don't need the Born rule from this point of view. You don't really need it, do you? Because you have the probabilities. Well, it still plays a role, but it doesn't play the role that it's usually perceived to play. The usual perception is that there's this thing, this independent entity, the quantum state, and from the quantum state, we can derive probabilities. But from our point of view, the probabilities are fundamental. The role of the Born rule now is actually, instead, not to give us probabilities from the quantum state, but to tell us how to transform probabilities. A quantum state is nothing other than making a probability assignment for the outcomes of this measurement, or the standard measurement. In that case, it was the pi's, excuse me, it was the pi's. Suppose now I want to consider a completely different measurement. What the Born rule tells me is that you, the Bayesian, can't independently set your probabilities for the new measurement. If you've set them for the first measurement, you've set them for all measurements. And there's a rule for calculating new probabilities from old probabilities. So again, this emphasizes that quantum mechanics is like adding an extra step of coherence in the Diffinetti sense, the physical one. So to Simon's world, where he takes quantum mechanics seriously, one can put a mirror world, the quantum Bayesian world, where I dare think that we take quantum mechanics every bit as seriously, but in a different way. So Simon had said, the theory should be universal. The decision theory should be a normative ideal for all physical agents universally. Without any special mention of a speculative ontology behind the agent's experience, which is what I tend to view the Everettian picture as, speculative ontology, but I'll just say it blatantly here, without any special mention of a speculative ontology behind the agent's experience, is at least before the first necessary moment, the moment called for by Martin Gardner's first quote, and without any additional ad hoc structures introduced for the fuzzy feeling of an ontologized dynamics, that which is called unitarity. Now, how does this interact with an Everettian view of things? Here's another lovely quote from David Deutsch. I said 13 quotes from Everettian papers. I cheated because sometimes I used blogs and sometimes I used interviews. Here's a case of an interview. David Deutsch was being interviewed and he said, the best physical reason for adopting the Everett interpretation lies in quantum cosmology. There one tries to apply quantum theory to the universe as a whole, considering the universe as a dynamical object starting with a Big Bang, evolving to form galaxies, and so on. Then when one tries, for example, by looking in a textbook to ask what the symbols in the quantum theory mean, how does one use the wave function of the universe or other mathematical objects that quantum theory employs to describe reality? One reads there, the meaning of these mathematical objects is as follows. First, consider an observer outside the quantum system under consideration. And immediately, one has to stop short. Postulating an outside observer is all very well when we're talking about a laboratory. We can imagine an observer sitting outside the experimental apparatus looking at it. But when the experimental apparatus, the object being described by quantum theory is the entire universe, it's logically inconsistent to imagine an observer sitting outside it. Therefore, the standard interpretation fails. It fails completely to describe quantum cosmology. Even if we knew how to write down the theory of quantum cosmology, which is quite hard, incidentally, we literally wouldn't know what the symbols meant under any interpretation other than the Everett interpretation. I remember a discussion in 1996 with John Preska, and I said, the reason you fear the point of view that we're trying to develop, I shouldn't have said fear with John Preska, if any of you who know him, is that you think we can't do quantum cosmology, don't you? And I confronted him, you think we can't do quantum cosmology? And he said, yes. And I said, let me show you. And I'll show you the same way, too. You write down a big wave function. There. I've done it. And now, well, but what's the meaning of that wave function? Deutsch said I couldn't do this at all. Now, remember the picture. There's the agent. This thing is the subject, the starting point of decision theory. And there's this little physical thing out there. And one can interact with this physical thing. Indeed, I am external to it. Just as Deutsch says, there's the agent. He's external to the physical thing. He performs actions on it. The actions have consequences. He captures his degrees of belief by the about the consequences of the actions with this state vector psi. Nothing wrong with that. But now, conceptually, take this physical system and extend it, make it bigger. Still nothing wrong with that. So you make it a little bigger. Still nothing wrong with this picture. And I think he implies that, in fact, in the interview. Make it really big. Still nothing wrong with it. So what is doing quantum cosmology? You ask yourself, what expectations do I have for baryon number? If I could imagine making a baryon number measurement in the universe, of the universe by looking at some observational data, I model that now by a positive operator valued measure. I ask myself, what are my expectations for the value of the Hubble constant? I write down my expectations for that, model it by a positive operator valued measure. I ask myself, what are my expectations about the distributions of galaxies and large-scale structure of the universe? I can easily write that down, model it by a positive operator valued measure. And so forth and so on, I go by some large number of things. And at the end of the day, I take all of these probability assignments that I have made, P1, whatever it was, P2, whatever it was, P3, whatever it was, and I distill all of these things into a big quantum state, the thing I call the state of the universe. And now I ask myself, what do I believe is, what is my expectation that Hugh Price will be wearing an orange shirt on the day he gives this next version of this presentation? and I should be able to derive it from that. That's what quantum cosmology is from this point of view. So let me end the talk by saying, or giving a criterion for what would actually turn me around and push me in the Everettian direction, because it's not impossible. Here's a page from Jackson's book on electrodynamics. And I like to use this example, particularly when talking about Bohmians, but I'll use it today for the Everettians. Jackson points out, as we all know, the Maxwell equations consist of a set of coupled first-order partial differential equations relating the various components of electric and magnetic fields. They can be solved as they stand in simple situations, but it is often convenient to introduce potentials, obtaining a smaller number of second-order equations while satisfying some of the Maxwell equations identically. Yada, yada, yada. It goes on. And then the rest of the book turns, maybe not the rest of the book, but much of the book turns toward actually solving problems. And what you find is that if, in addition to the object in the theory that represents physical reality, the fields, if in addition to that you introduce a further object, the potentials, you can solve problems that you couldn't have otherwise. It makes life easier to introduce the potentials. Well, similarly, I usually challenge the Bohmians with this idea. I'm really not bothered by the idea that the trajectories are invisible. I'm willing to grant them be there if I find them pragmatically useful. What I mean by that is, let me pick some problem that has vexed me for a long time, something from my career, quantum information. Some quantum information problem, say, or someone else may do some fluid mechanics problem, something else. But let me pick the problem, one that has troubled me, one that I can't do because my techniques are perhaps primitive, and give it to you, the Bohmian, who has added trajectories. You not only have the wave equation, but you have the trajectories. With the introduction of that, can you solve the problem that's been tough for me? I'm just asking that your theory be useful. It not only be useful to you, but that it be useful to the wider world. If you can do that, I'll turn my head and I'll pay attention. Similarly, now I'll say for the Everettian, if by letting quantum be quantum in your way and recognizing the simultaneous existence of the various branches, if by introducing that you can help me solve some problems that I couldn't have before, I will pay attention. I'll pay attention deeply. Now, quantum computation is usually used as an example of that. I'm ending you. Yes. Here are a couple of quotes from David Deutsch. The idea that quantum theory is a true description of physical reality led Everett and many subsequent investigators to explain quantum mechanical phenomena in terms of the simultaneous existence of parallel universes. Similarly, I and others have explained the power of quantum computation in terms of quantum parallelism, many classical computations occurring in parallel. And he goes on to give an example. When a factoring engine is factorizing a 250-digit number, it's because you have the big multiverse working away at it, and you can work with exponentially smaller steps. So maybe that's enough to turn my head. And sometimes I think it is. But I thought it would be fun to ask some of the founders of quantum computation what they thought and how much it actually guided their thoughts. So I'll end with just this. I sent Peter Shor a questionnaire. Did you know the Everett interpretation before starting work on your factoring algorithm? He said yes. If so, was the many worlds view or the idea of parallel computations via parallel worlds something that was integral to your thinking for finding the algorithm? If it was part of the main imagery that steered your mathematics, can you say in what way? If it wasn't part of your main imagery, can you say what was? He said, no, the idea was really more to use periodicity and inspired by Simon's algorithm. Fine. And then he goes on to say something else that I'll come back to. But then I thought it was fun. I wrote Dan Simon the same questionnaire. because Peter said he really relied more on periodicity and Simon's algorithm to find his algorithm, not so much many worlds imagery. So I asked Dan Simon, did you know the Everett interpretation before starting work on your algorithm? Who's Everett and what's his interpretation? So I had a bit more material to show you, including sending the questionnaire to other people, but I think I'll just go ahead and cut it off here and say I hope I've expressed my doubts at least a little, and thanks for having this great meeting.
Quoting blogs, Scott Aronson, who is an expert on quantum computation, which I'm not, says that in fact this parallel universe thing is not only completely wrong, it says that true parallelism gives you more power than quantum computing would solve the P equals NP problem, whereas quantum computing would not.
Yeah. Let me put up Peter Shor's quote again. Let me just go ahead and read the rest of it. So the next question was, would you say that the developments of quantum information and computation were evidence that something is really right about the Everett view? Or do you think the developments of quantum information are relatively neutral to Everett? Peter's answer was, you should have heard my after-dinner talk in Japan. Both the Everett view and the Copenhagen view are misleading in thinking about quantum computation, although misleading in quite different ways. Computer scientists who hear about the Everett interpretation construct a mental model that a quantum computer is many worlds in parallel that can all interact, so that they should be able to do polynomial depth exponential numbers. And there's a little bit of a mismatch in there. I think you meant it. So you should be able to do polynomial depth exponential numbers of processes of classical computation. This is the exponential analog of the complexity class MC, and is much, much more powerful computation than the real class that the different quantum computers meet, BQP. So it's, you know, these aren't strict arguments that it's the wrong view to take. You could just find the wrong intuition. But I think there's some greater truth to that. And he should know more than anyone else. Oh, can I follow up on that? Mm-hmm. At Adrian's insistence, Adrian Kim's insistence, I sent the same thing to David Deutsch. And he said, yes. And you can agree. Okay. But in my question, I said, did you know about the Everett interpretation before starting work on the Deutsch-Joseph algorithm? And he said, you know, that it was helpful and so forth. And then I sent the same questionnaire to Joseph. And Joseph's answers were not of the same flavor. He says, I've known about the Everett interpretation since the mid-1970s, never really adopted it or liked it. Even from the outset, it always was and still is very vague and incomplete framework to me. I'm not aware that the Everett ideas have ever played any significant role in my thinking on quantum things. I don't have a clear impression of any particular imagery that I can name underlying or guiding my quantum thoughts. And ultimately, he says, I do not see that any quantum computation or informational developments particularly support the Everett view. That would be the vast majority, I sent this out to about 20 people. Everyone came back with answers of the flavor of Richards, except for David Deutsch and Arthur Eckert, for whatever that's worth.
Hey, but you need Richards again. Hmm? Deutsch again. That's
something in the most general space.
Could you put the quote from Alex Wilson?
After. Do you disagree with it?
No, I think it's absolutely lovely.
Have you seen his paper?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I really should start using PowerPoint.
So if an interpretation can be kept aloft even in the thin atmosphere, completely general, non-classical probabilistic theory, So, you know, we can ask the question, can the Everettian interpretation be kept alive in such a context? Now, if you look at these generalized probabilistic theories, it really doesn't seem easy to see how you can keep an Everett interpretation alive for most of them. The success of the Everett interpretation, first of all, seems to depend quite crucially on things like facts about decoherence, which enable one to see a branching structure at all in the first place. And even if there were some of these theories where something like that worked and you could get a branching structure, I've no idea what would happen to the arguments about probabilities of, you know, the Deutsch-Wallace derivation. So suppose I
could have you explored them enough to know how many you get decoherence effects in, for instance?
I haven't explored enough to. But what I was going to say now was, since I did and was able to make that sort of suggestion much more precise and convincing, sort of really turned out that Everett only really worked in quantum or maybe a very small number of cases. Would that sway you in any way towards it?
I think it would make me more sympathetic. Certainly, I wouldn't be as dismissive as, I mean, look, you know, I'm out here, I'm being dismissive in front of an audience that can beat the hell out of me. But, you know, the main thing that would go toward making me feel better would be it somehow passing a pragmatic test and doing it really well, really phenomenally. But I also, this issue of better understanding the interplay of measurement, as I like to think of measurement, as an agent doing this and that, and some big wider structure. In your general probabilistic theories, you go all the way from hidden variable, ones that allow hidden variable models, to ones that don't, and God knows what all is in between. Correct.
In a certain sense, they all trivially allow non-local hidden variable.
Oh, non-local. But some are of the flavor of Rob's toy model, where there's just simply epistemic restrictions. And, you know, one of the cutest things that I ever heard was when Rob first talked about his toy model and John Smolin was listening to it, John said, you should give an Everettian interpretation of it. And he was serious about it. So here was a case where we had a model that explicitly had local hidden variables underneath it. And John thought it was easy to understand if he introduced an Everettian picture, which didn't help build my faith that there's something unique in Everettian view of the world. But yeah, I think it would make me think.
We've got 5 minutes left, and I've got 5 people on my list of questions, so I'm just going to ask you very briefly and see how well we can get through the finish.
Yeah, I get one big focus there to know, so he's cheap memory. The first is John Haldane's one, people saying the evolution fan testing one. He said, what persuaded interchange mind there? And he's described the fossil mammoths in the pre-crack Cambrian. So I think that there's a framework that says, look, what's the general way to think? There's also a framework that says, what specifically in the science we're doing persuaded? For me, specifically the science we're doing is a failure of the decoherence program. Or maybe an experimental population and uncharity. So that's kind of applied to the experimental process along the flavor that we talked about in another quote that is still in the time. The other quote is from Dave Hilbert. And in terms of it's not weird enough, you're not being the quantum sufficiently weird. Sid Brower in the 20s was very much pushing intuitionism as a revolution, very much pushing the picture that killing, etc., running the sort of same old approach as we learned so much about mathematics wasn't being weird enough, to paraphrase, wasn't being that bit. And Hilbert's response was something like, basically, something like one man's revolution is another man's coup, and so I'm using the words. I fear that this approach to Descartes is an attempt at a coup against science in general, and science in general talks in this way of external states outside there. Maybe it's a revolutionary change in all science change. It's any more. I expect a quote from you, darling.
Well, that was fair. I mean, that's fair enough. Of course, I never fit inside of my talks, and I like to think that ultimately I'm not rejecting science as you can see. I like to think that. Maybe you'll tell me that I'm being inconsistent, but I like to think that what we have not been doing sufficiently in our quantum mechanical games is something along the lines of what of the David Merman report, where he says something about the exquisite separation between the information and the objective physical world. So my strategy has always been, not always, always, I used to be a deadpan frequentist. I've gone through all of these phases, and then I was a closet daisy, and now I'm not a closet. But my strategy of the last few years has been to try to isolate all the terms that can be easily interpreted as information, reasonably, decision theory, entities, and see what remains behind. And the stuff that remains behind, I believe, will fit into the kind of picture that you have in science, that I posit that the components of the world are substances of character X, something like that. And that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. But it feels to me that we're stuck at this stage with mostly the decision theory piece that was down here, and we still have to do some distillation before we get the good stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you're not going to ask me again whether I've solved the original problem. You did that to me 7 years ago. It was a great impression. Do you remember my answer? What was it? Simon said very confidently, "Are you saying that you solved the measurement?" And I said, "I'm saying it never existed."
Just to comment about, I wouldn't quite use the Deutsch rhetoric. Seriously, that was a list I put up, was just understanding what realism and fundamental theory. But I guess my question is about certain sort of descriptivism, call it that, and which I think you are rejecting, but I'm not entirely sure you're rejecting. And descriptivism is this point. Is a description available in a closed system which has got observers inside it? Is a schematic description available or not? And I would take that as a characterization of a certain sort of realism. Would you reject that goal of aspiration to provide a description of a closed system with observers inside? Is that just simply your piece of metaphysics? Or an aspiration one might have had, but no, it turns out we can't have it because of quantum theory?
I wish I could find the transparency. Two transparencies. One is this. One is this. And well, this is one. One transparency. And then the other one had to be my comparison, the mirror world from your world on it. I think it would be useful if I could find it. You know, right, I used to every now and then see a talk by old Russian professors and they would have their secretaries with them. Mm-hmm. When giving talks just for things like this. So I think that most of everything I say hinges on trying to preserve a category distinction that I feel that most people not so much necessarily the Everettian camp, but I'm not sure, try to blur over in late discussions of information theoretic implications on quantum foundations. So for instance, Jeff Boob, after listening to me for a while, said, yes, information is important. And then he quickly started writing papers that effectively ontologize information, which is a great disappointment to me. So here I said, let's focus on this piece of the world and describe it from his point of view. Then we use decision theoretic terms. The decision theoretic language, the decision theoretic talk, the probability talk, in the talk. And he has no problem with calling this a physical system, what my figure is. He has no problem with calling this a physical system. He should have no problem calling this a physical system. So if that's what you mean by including the observer in the description, then yeah, he's doing it. because there's nothing of principle that's different between this little stick figure and this smudge up. But if we now come to his point of view, it's a different story. This is now a physical system, and that is a physical system. But he is still living in the point of view of the agent. So, if you will, maybe a good way to say it is there are internal points of view, and we have a good handle on the internal points of view for some systems, namely decision-making agents. And then there are external points of view, and those are two different things. What we don't have in physical theory presently is any sense of what the internal point of view looks like when we're talking about an electron. Sorry. Electron presumably is not a decision-making agent. I don't know how to put myself in the head of an electron.
But I do know how to put myself in your head, to some extent. And so I feel comfortable saying that the way I interact with the world is roughly the way I perceive myself interacting with the world is roughly the way you perceive yourself interacting with the world. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, an apology to people still on this, but you can now go and interact. Maybe I want to say a couple things, but before